This morning, during the Sunday school, we will come to a book that most of you have maybe never read or read and wondered about. It's the book of Lamentations. The book of Lamentations you will find right after the book of Jeremiah, for it is written a book written by the prophet Jeremiah. The lesson this morning I titled A Reader's Guide to the Book of Lamentations. Oftentimes, it's not easy to read certain books. I brought you a little picture here. What do you see on this picture? You see, first you see a face, and then if you look closer, you actually see a couple of flowers and a little butterfly flowing into it. So what do you see on this picture? Oh, nope. What do you see on this picture? There again, you first see a face, and then if you look closer, you actually see birds, three birds flying into a little nest. So oftentimes, it's very much the same with the books in the Bible. We maybe read them and we perceive a certain thing, but the books of the Bible are written in a way that we should pay good attention to the details and possibly to keys within the book that tell us how the book should be read. Yeah? I believe, due to my studies in the Old Testament, that oftentimes the key to really understanding a book is to understand the structure of the book. Just yesterday I was discussing with your pastor that really the Old Testament books all should be perceived as, let's say, a sermon. A sermon that is carefully crafted. Maybe carefully crafted by putting various historical details and stories together. Maybe carefully crafted by putting different psalms in a certain order and with maybe various scenes, various transitional psalms that maybe then tell us how we should interpret the surrounding psalms. Or maybe a collection of proverbs or a collection of prophetic oracles. It is very important for us to get the larger picture and to then read each detail in its own context. And that is really what we want to do this morning with the book of Lamentations. I would like to illustrate to you how this book is carefully crafted on a literary level, on a canonical rhetorical level, and then also on the theological level. A lot of my studies this morning that I present are easier to really understand or to really have insight in if you read the book in Hebrew. Now, most of you, or probably none of you, will read this book in Hebrew. So maybe some of the things that I illustrate to you this morning, you're like, come on, look at this English Bible. I don't see what you're talking about. Well, my observations are based on the Hebrew Bible, and most of you hopefully will have a good translation that will reflect the same. I myself will read from the ESV, maybe the New American Standard Bible would be the Bible where you can follow closest with some of these conclusions, for it is maybe more representing the Hebrew wording. Let me then, first of all, show you the parts of the literary structure of Lamentations. Now, maybe as a little introduction, I think there's probably no other book in the Old Testament that is more carefully crafted than the book of Lamentations. And when you leave this morning, I think you will realize that for yourself. First of all, you have 5 chapters in this book. 5 chapters, we could also say 5 poems, which build a unit in and of itself. Why do I say that each one of these 5 chapters builds a unit in and of itself, a poem in and of itself? Well, as you follow this text in the Hebrew Bible, you will see that the first, the second, the third, and the fourth chapter is built on an acrostic. what does acrostic mean? You know maybe the word acrostic from Psalm 119. You know, Psalm 119 has 22 stanzas of 8 verses, and each one of those 8 verses starts with the same Hebrew letter. The first 8 verses with the letter Aleph, A, then with the second unit of 8 verses with the letter Beth, B, and on and on. There's 22 letters to the Hebrew alphabet, so you end up with 22 stanzas to the Psalm 119. Well, here in Lamentations 1, 2, 3, and 4, so really in each one of the chapters, except for the final one, you find an acrostic. For example, here in chapter 1, verse 1, you would have 3 sections, and each one of these sections starts with the letter A. Verse 2 starts with the letter Beth. Again, three lines to this verse, and each one of these lines starts with the letter B, and on and on. And as you look at the last verse is verse 22. So here we then would have the last unit were 3 times, 3 lines are introduced by the letter Tav. You have the same chapter in chapter 2. Then actually in chapter 3 you have 66 verses. Here it is again obvious. You have 3 verses with the same letter. Then chapter 4, verse 4 starts with the second letter and on and on. Now it's interesting that as you go through Lamentations, the acrostic becomes less and less complicated. Yeah? So the craftiness, or not the craftiness, but the literary craft here becomes less and less until then in chapter 5 you don't have any acrostic anymore. Yeah? You have a Aleph at the very beginning, you have your Tav at the last verse, and then right the middle verse has the middle letters of the alphabet. So you have a imitated mini acrostic, but it's almost like this acrostic is dying away. It gets less and less complicated. Now, why is this interesting? That somehow this careful literary structure of the acrostic gets less and less complicated until in the last chapter, the last poem, you don't have it anymore. It's dying away. Now, the whole book of Lamentations is a lament, a grieving over the fall of Israel, over the destruction of Jerusalem, over the loss of the king, over the fact that all the curses that God had predicted to the people of Israel in the book of Deuteronomy have now come over them, with that greatest curse of all, that they are expelled from their land, that their city, Jerusalem, is destroyed, and other grievous curses, like the fact that the mothers are eating their own children, that the children are going into slavery. Everything that Israel ever hoped in is destroyed. And that is what these 5 poems wrestle with. The prophet Jeremiah tries to comfort his countrymen with this poem. He tries to come alongside them in his grief, in their grief, to try to share their grief, and as the prophet of the Lord, lead them out of this grief. And how he does that, actually the structure that we are considering this morning will communicate to us. So we have a dying away of the acrostic. Well, secondly, then, we have an additional literary structure, literary artistry in this book, and that is that we have concentric responses. Look with me at chapter 1. And unfortunately, maybe some of these words are not easy to read for you. But here again, I wrote the letters of the Hebrew alphabet. Yeah, you have the Aleph, then the Beit, then the Gimel, then the Dalet, A, B, C, D. Stanzas, yeah, so verse 1, verse 2, verse 3, verse 4. In the very first stanza, the word in the Aleph stanza, or line, you have the word great mentioned. And now you say, wow, that's great. Well, look with me at verse 22, and here it gets complicated because the Hebrew Bible would maybe have certain word choices that the English doesn't communicate. In verse 1 it says, she who was great among the nations, yeah, she who was princess among the provinces has become a slave. She who was great among the nations. Well, now in the very last verse, we read in the last line, for my groans are many, and my heart is faint. The Hebrew, he actually says, my groans are great, and my heart is faint. So we see here, the book is organized in a way where you have a word in the beginning, and it's reflected, it is repeated in a concentric way in the verse that that is on the same level with it. Yeah. So you have great in the first verse, great in the last verse. You have in verse 2 the phrase "none to comfort me." We read here. She weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks among all her lovers. She has none to comfort her. Now the communicating verse, the verse on the same level with the second verse, would be verse 21. And long and behold, in verse 21, we read again, they heard my groaning, yet there is no comforter to me. And you might think, well, Kai, that's just coincidence. Well, I dare you. Go through the whole chapter, and you will see that in verse 1, there is a word that corresponds to a word that is also found in 22. Verse 2 corresponds to verse 21. Verse 3 has a word that corresponds with a word that you find in verse 20. And on, so that you have kind of this form of a chiasm. Yeah, this is chiasm, the Greek word chi. It's like an X. You take half an X, and that's what you see. You see a half an X here to represent this constructed responses in Lamentations 1. Well, as we then read in verse chapter 2, we'll find the same thing again. We again find a concentric structure where words are correspondent in this kind of a chiasm. Chapter 3, we find it again, but not as consistently as in chapter 1 and 2. Chapter 4, we don't find it. Chapter 5, we don't find it. So very interesting. Here again, when it comes to the concentric responses, again, there is a sense of dying away. All that craftiness, all that careful literary structure with regard to the concentric, these chiasms, it gets less and less careful as the book goes on, and then in chapter 4 and 5 totally falls away. Now, this already is pretty artistic for author to write, not only be careful that each one of the lines starts with the same acrostic letter, but then even to be able to have both in the first, second, and third chapter, to some degree, such a concentric response. But that's not where the artistic ability of Jeremiah, when he writes these five poems, stops. Thirdly, we also have concatenation. I don't even know how to pronounce that word, so I don't expect most of you to know what that is. Well, a concatenation would be chaining. Yeah, you have little links of a chain that are linked together so that each one of these poems builds a chain of rhymes, we could say. Now let me illustrate this point to you. Read with me again in chapter 1. We'll illustrate it there. And read verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. People, that would be the same word that would also in the Hebrew be translated as nations. Well, let's now go down to verse 3. And long and behold, we read here, she weeps bitterly in the night with tears on her cheeks among all her lovers, and she has none to comfort her. All her friends have dealt... Okay, that's verse 2. So I'm not going to be successful in this verse. Let's sit down to verse 3. Okay, so the people in verse 1 now nations in verse 3. Judah has gone into exile because of affliction and hard servitude. She dwells now among the people, among the nations, but finds no resting place. Her pursuers have all taken over her in the midst of her distress. Verse 1 is linked to verse 3 by this word, peoples, nations. Well, let's then read in verse 2 the Beit stanza, where actually the word that connects verse 2 to verse 4 would be just the simple pronoun her. You find the word her both in verse 2 and then in verse 4. So maybe that could be a coincidence. But then, let's read in verse 2 the word much. Cool. She weeps much in the night. She weeps bitterly in the night. Verse 4 then, the roads of Zion mourn, for none come to the festival. All her gates are desolate. Her priests groan, her virgins have been afflicted, and she herself suffers bitterly. Yeah? All her gates are desolate. This much and all, again, is one and the same word, the word kol in Hebrew. Yeah? Maybe, let's then also read in verse 3, where not only is the word nations mentioned, but also the word Zion. Verse 4, the roads of Zion mourn. Yeah, and then in verse 6, from the daughters of Zion, all her majesty has departed. So, as you follow along this, you will see that verse 1 is linked to verse 3. Verse 2 is linked to verse 4. Verse 3 is not only linked to verse 1, but also linked to verse 5. Verse 4 is not only linked to verse 2, but it's also linked to verse 6. And on and on. So you have a careful concatenation of each one of the verses with the next with the following verse. You find the same then in chapter 2, where the concatenation looks a little bit different. There we don't skip a verse, we don't go from verse 1 to verse 3, but we actually go from verse 1 to verse 2, and then verse 2 to 3, so that verse 2 is connected to verse 1 and to verse 3, rather than skipping over. In verse chapter 3, chapter 4, chapter 5, you don't have this concatenation. So we see, the more we read it, the more artistically structured and carefully crafted we realize this book is. I dare any of you read a book, read Moby Dick, read whatever, read other chapters of the Bible, and try this. And see, okay, Kai, you are reading this into this text, this is mere coincidence. Well, read another chapter in the Bible, and try to find this kind of pattern. Nay, if you do it in the English Bible, I would be very surprised. Yeah? This is not coincidence, this is intended by the author, who carefully crafted it this way. And I'm sorry, you read your Hebrew, your English Bible, and you cannot 100% see what I am showing you here. There again, because the English translators at one time will maybe translate the word goyim as nations, at another time as the peoples. Yeah? They will use different words to translate it, and thereby some of the structure is lost to us, and we cannot see that as clearly as the author intends it for us. Here again, then, both on the acrostic level, the concentric response level, and the concatenation, you see there is a dying away. Now, has anybody of you ever actually read this book? Okay? When you read this book, is there anything that you noticed? Anything that stands out to you? Anything that you remember about who is speaking here? You many times find, in this book specifically, Jerusalem is personified as a woman. Yeah, the city of Jerusalem is talked about like a woman. And we already read a couple of verses. For example, it starts, Haloni sits the city. She was full of people. She's looked like an impure woman who sits there in her own impurity and who is mourning. But not only is she described, but at times, in the book of Lamentations, this woman now takes the word and starts speaking. The personified city of Jerusalem speaks. So you have in the five chapters various voices. And that is now the next point that we want to get to. We want to start talking about these voices. Yeah. Here in chapter 1, verse 1, clearly we have someone describing it, describing this woman. So in third person. So I call this the prophet. The prophet here in the first section is describing the woman. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become, she who was great among the nations. And on and on and on. But then, look with me at verse 9. Up to verse 9, still the prophet, the narrator, how he's oftentimes called, continues to speak. Her uncleanness was in her skirts. She took no thought of her future, therefore her fall is terrible. She has no comforter. And now, O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed. Without much introduction, without saying, and now the woman says, or the city speaks, we all know. The one that now suddenly speaks in the second part of verse 9, O Lord, behold my affliction, for the enemy has triumphed, it's the woman. It's the city itself that is speaking. So we here have a shift in speaking voice. It was the narrator, the prophet that spoke, and now the woman herself, the personified city, takes the word and starts speaking. Verse 10, we are back to the narrator, the prophet. The enemy has stretched out his hands over all her precious things, for she hath seen the nations enter her sanctuary, those whom you forbade to enter your congregation. The prophet speaking to God. You, God, have forbidden that they should enter into your temple, your congregations. Then at the end of verse 9, we again have a shift back to the woman speaking. And so we go back and forth between the woman and the prophet himself speaking. In chapter 2, verse 13, the prophet then also directly addresses the woman. So he doesn't only narrate, but he also now talks to the woman, to the personified city. In chapter 2, verse 13, what can I say for you? To what compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What can I liken to you that I may comfort you, O virgin daughter of Zion? For your ruin is vast in the sea. Who can heal you? As we now go through the five chapters of this book and try to mark each one of the changes of shift of voice from the woman speaking to the male prophet speaking, we also then in chapter 3 and chapter 5 find a third group that I would call the community. Yeah. In the end of chapter 3, we read, for example, in verse 42, or 40 actually, let us test and examine our ways and return to the Lord. Let us lift up our hearts and hands to God in heaven. We have transgressed and rebelled, and you have not forgiven. So a third voice then would be the community. The prophet here gives a voice to the people, the citizens of Jerusalem as a whole, and they, as a congregation, as a community, are speaking in first person plural. Now, as we carefully look at the shifts of voices, and also see that there are chapter breaks and section breaks in each one of the chapters, we find 22 sections in this book. 21 times, the speaking voice is shifting. Yeah? Someone else takes the words. Now, what is significant about the fact that it is 22? We have an acrostic in this book, and the acrostic means that we have how many verses in the first chapter? 22. Chapter 3 is 66, because each line has its own verse. So, 22 is the dominating number in this book. So not only is each poem divided in 22 verses by way of the acrostic, but now the five poems as a whole are divided in 22 sections by means of dividing it, marking the division by the change of speaking voice. From the prophet to the woman, from the woman to the prophet, from the prophet to the woman, from the prophet, possibly then in chapter 3, 4, and 5, to the community, to the first person plural, the person that speaks in we and us. Okay, Kai. Are you reading that into this? Or is this really what the author intended? And let me tell you, the author intended this. Why can I say that? Here I have a table where I carefully went through each one of these sections marked by a shift in speaking voice, and I counted together all the words that the prophet, the narrator, the prophet, the one that speaks about the woman and to the woman and to the community is speaking. And it is 1,082 words. Then I took all the words that Zion, the personified city of Zion, that woman is speaking. And it is 281 words. Then I counted together in chapter 3, 4, and 5 all the words that the community speaks. And it is 280 words. So in other words, the prophet, the writer of this book, managed to exactly give 70% of that what is spoken in this book and designated, make it be spoken from the prophet's mouth. 15% of the words, 280 words, are spoken by Zion, the personified woman. The community then speaks again 15%. 70, 15, 15, makes 100% of the words. That is how carefully the author, Jeremiah, crafted this book. But let me make another conclusion here. According to this table that I show you here, who is speaking the most? It is the prophet. Now, many people look at this book and they say, it is a description of the grief of Jerusalem, the grief of this personified woman, the daughter of Zion, the daughter of Jerusalem. But according to who is really speaking here, who would you say this book is about? Is it about Zion, or who is it about? It's about the prophet. Yeah, he's the one that speaks the most. It's not the woman that speaks the most. Obviously, the content of the discussion is the grief of this woman. But more specifically, I would like to come back to the verse that I just read in chapter 2, verse 13. The entire book can be understood as the prophet wrestling. How can I comfort Jerusalem? Jerusalem which has fallen, Jerusalem which has brought about herself all this grief because of her own sin. How do you help someone who has chosen sin for himself? Especially, how do you help someone who has chosen sin for himself if you already have been the one telling him all the way along, this is not going to be good in the end. You are going to reap what you sow. None of us wants to listen to a spouse or a parent or a friend who has for years told us, don't do this. It's going to cause you grief. And then we find ourselves in grief. The last person we're going to turn to is that person that has warned us all the way along. That's the exact situation in which the prophet Jeremiah finds himself, who here clearly speaks in chapter 2, verse 13, and I read it again. What can I say for you, Jerusalem? To what can I compare you, O daughter of Jerusalem? What can I liken to you that I may comfort you? There's no comforter that you have left. I, the prophet Jeremiah, I want to help you. I want to comfort you. But how can I? For your ruin is vast as the sea, who can hear you? This book is about a prophet who is wrestling, how can he help his suffering counselee? You could almost say this book is a counseling manual. Well, the form that he chooses, the form of, again, taking the reader into these three different voices, is the answer to his struggle. The author chose the different speaking voices, we might on a literary level also call them persona, as a rhetorical means of expressing his personal struggle in counseling the people of Zion in their grief, for which they are ultimately personally responsible because they brought it about by their own sin. This verse, Lamentations 2 verse 3, communicates the purpose for the author's use of the three speaking voices. The author who speaks in the voice of the prophet had been greatly ridiculed and oppressed by his own people. And this great ridicule, his own struggle, his own suffering, he describes to us in the third poem, chapter 3. He himself there says how he himself has felt the hand of God on his life, the heavy, the grievous hand of the Lord on his life. He has been ridiculed, he has been oppressed by his own countrymen. And it's these countrymen that have oppressed him, that have ridiculed him, because he had preached to them the truth, that now he tries to help. Yet, he has the true answer to their struggles. He is the one, the man of God, the prophet of the Lord, who does know the answer. From his own experience now, he sees that he can help others to find their way back to God in time of grief and suffering. He himself had been in that deep valley of death, that valley of deep darkness. He himself had to counsel himself and help himself out of this deep hole. And by leading the people of Israel in the form of these three different speaking voices, leading them from voice to voice, putting words into their mouths, and communicating himself as a prophet to them, he seeks to take them into his own world, that they might see how he has found help in deep grief, that they also might find help in such deep distress. He faces the difficulty that the people would never listen to him, whom they had despised for so long. Thus the author raises the question, how shall I admonish you, who can heal you, here in chapter 2, verse 13. And it is through the form of the different speaking voices that the author could accomplish this goal. That's why he chose this form of communicating through the Book of Lamentations with the people of Israel. Taking them into, putting words into their mouth, and thereby leading them that they come to the same point that he has come to, that then was the turning point out of this grief. And now you wonder, what is it that the prophet himself has experienced that helped him to come out of this deep despair and this deep grief? I will answer this question of how does the prophet himself come out of this grief in just a second. But let me first show you another way how the author of this book, how Jeremiah, carefully constructed this book. Not only is this 22-fold division of the book supported by the fact that all the words of the prophet, all the words of Zion, all the words of the community add up to 70%, 15%, 15%, like I just showed you. Another way how not only the whole book is carefully structured, but how even each one of these 22 individual sections is carefully structured, is that we find a central word, a central phrase, or a sentence in each section. And that is where we have a handout. Did we already hand that out?
Yeah.
As you look at your handout, you will find approximately that what I have up here, the table 2. And here again, if we had our Hebrew Bibles, we could now look at each section and exactly count how many words are in each section.
Yeah.
As I said, we just already added up all these words and came up with this equation 70%, 15%, 15%. But as we now look at the individual sections, we for example, look at the first section, which goes from chapter 1, verse 1, to chapter 9, chapter 1, verse 9b. Yeah, if each verse is divided into three sections, then we basically have chapter 1, verse 9c as section number 2. But here, we then have 148 words in these 9 verses. As we now count, we find that right in the middle of this section, and I can't even read my own computer, so can I have a handout too? Okay. Okay, verse 5. Okay, that's good. Okay. Verse 5. We have right in the middle, in verse 5, this section, the Lord, Yahweh, has caused her grief. He has afflicted her because of the multitude of her transgressions. Her little children have gone away, as captives. Yeah? We take these words, which in Hebrew would be exactly 8 words. There again. From, the Lord hath afflicted her for the multitude of her transgressions. Her children have gone away as captives. That's 8 words in Hebrew, and I think each one of you would agree with me. That's pretty much something that is a unit in and of itself. Yeah, this is a complete sentence. It's not that I somehow cut off something, but there's closure. This phrase, these 8 words, as I read these as one part, they make up one unit in and of itself again. Now, what's significant about this? You have 70 words, then these 8 words that I just read, and then you have another 70 words. So in other words, in the middle of this 148 word long section, you have 8 words that in and of itself build a unit, closure. And the significant thing is that as you read these 9 verses, these 8 middle words that you find here in verse 5, summarize for me what really these 9 verses are saying. I go through the entire book, and each one of the 22 sections, again and again, I find an exact middle section, maybe a phrase, maybe an entire sentence, maybe an entire verse, maybe just one word that summarizes overall what this section is communicating. There again, I dare you, take any chapter in the Bible and see if you would find the same phenomenon. Take Moby Dick. Divide it up in its own sections, paragraphs, and see if it works. And then decide for yourself whether this is coincidence or whether even to this detail, Jeremiah carefully constructed this book where he supports the 22-fold division by way of putting a word, a phrase, or a sentence right smack in the middle, in the center of each unit, that summarizes and communicates to us what really this section is trying to express. So, on this level then, first of all, it supports the careful structuring of 22-fold structuring of this book. But we have in these 22 sections then a further structuring, and that is that as we look at section number 6, which is chapter 2, verse 26, we realize that section number 26 summarizes for me what the first five sections have expressed. In the same way then, section 11, which is chapter 2, verses 20 through 22, summarizes for me what the section 7 through 10 have communicated. In the same way then, section number 12, section 12, which is chapter 3, verses 1 through 33. I can't read my own handwriting here. Which kind of foreshadows what sections 13 through 16 talk about. In the same way then, section 17 foreshadows what sections 18 to 22 talk about. Now, there again, it would take a lot of your reading it and taking this text in to recognize, let's say, this careful symmetric arrangement of these units in and of itself. And we don't want to go more into detail. I don't want to bore you with details here. But let me come to the answering of how does the prophet, by means of jumping from one voice to another, best communicate to the people of Israel. Now, section 11, section 12, you already see, are right in the center. They are central. The one summarizes the preceding sections. Section 12 foreshadows what sections 13 through 16 will wrestle with. Central sections. Let's go and look at section number 12, one of these middle ones. What is the, in this section, which goes from chapter 3, verse 1 to verse 33, what is the middle part, the central section of this section? What is the little phrase that summarizes these 33 verses? We find it in chapter 3, verse 18. So I said, my strength has perished. Totally taking this verse now out of its context, this verse summarizes what the prophet himself has experienced. The prophet himself gives his testimony here in chapter 3, verses 1 through 33. And right here in verse 18 is the key. So how did he cope with his grief? How did he find the way out of his grief? And it is summarized in this sentence. So I said, my strength has perished. The prophet himself had to come to a point where he depends on nothing but the grace of the Lord. The one verse that you probably all know from Lamentations is, great is thy faithfulness. That song, Great is Thy Faithfulness, you sing it many times. That is based on chapter 3, verse 22. And this is the point that the prophet had to come to, where he absolutely resigns himself to the Lord. Where he said, I'm not going to look at my own ability, at my own righteousness, at my own strength. But I come to the point where I say, my strength has perished. Where I absolutely resign myself to the Lord. And here in chapter 3, the main point that is driven home is captured in this thought. Is it not the Lord that brings grief, that brings trouble, that brings the evil to a city? Is it not, if there is, verse 38, for example, is it not from the mouth of the Most High that good and bad come? Verse 37, who has spoken it came to pass unless the Lord has commanded it? It is the Lord who brings, who in whose hand both the good and the bad lies. It is, so this chapter drives home the sovereignty of the Lord. It is, man is utterly dependent on the Lord. And just as the Lord is able to bring evil over the city, is able to bring punishment over us, he is also the one who will bring salvation over us, who will cause the good. And it is this exact resignation to the sovereignty of the Lord, where then he knows he doesn't meet a God who is evil in his intentions. Where he acknowledges, God is not out to destroy me, but God is out to bless me. God is out to show me his grace. Great is his faithfulness. Morning by morning, his mercies are new. That's the key thought. That is what the prophet himself realized. This is what has helped me in my grief. And to this point, he now, through this change of speaking voices, he tries to lead the people of Israel, which is not easy. It's a people that doesn't want to listen to him. But yet he hopes by taking them through reading with them and speaking these voices with them, that they themselves would listen to him. And let's see then in the very, very last chapter, in the very, very last verses, how does he leave them? He puts these words into their mouth, where he, through these words, exactly tries to lead them to the same conclusion. There is no way out of our grief. There is no hope for us unless we absolutely resign ourselves to the sovereign hand of God and say, God, do with us whatever pleases you. You have any right to do it. And just as all the evil that has come over us is coming from your hand, we know that you are able to also bring good things to us. And the one thing we want to depend on is the fact that you have said to us, you are a God of chesed, a God of loving kindness, a God of grace, a God of mercy. A word that is very central here in chapter 3:22, when we say, great is thy faithfulness, your mercies are new every morning, that mercies, that is the chesed, the loving kindness of the Lord. Well, here, how does he then leave them? How does he lead them exactly to this point of resignation by putting these words in his mouth? And then the whole poem is at its end. Restore us, verse 21, restore us to yourself, O Lord, that we may be restored. Renew our days as of old, unless you have utterly rejected us and you remain exceedingly angry with us. Saying, God, we don't look to ourselves. We don't look to ourselves to justify ourselves. We don't look to ourselves as saying, we have the strength. We don't turn to Egypt or to other nations to say, they're the ones that help us out of this grief, out of this despair. But they say, God, you are the source of our restoration. And you know, we utterly make ourselves dependent on you by acknowledging, you do with us what you please. But we can do that. We can resign ourselves to you because we know that you are a God of loving kindness. The prophet has come to this point, so I said to myself, my strength is perished. And now, by leaving them with these words, putting them in their mouth, he leads them also to come to this conclusion. Now, we didn't talk much about the theological context now of the book of Lamentations, but may I say to you, what you heard this morning is the gospel according to Lamentations. This, what Jeremiah carefully tries to lead the people of Israel into, is the gospel. There's no salvation unless we, with these exact same words that we read here in chapter 5, verse 21 to 22, unless we come with these words to the Lord, there is no salvation to us. It's not that we say, God, I still can look at my own goodness, my own righteousness. It is my works that help me. It is my church that helps me and secures me your favor. No. Salvation lies therein that I absolutely resign myself to nothing but the mercy of the Lord. That I come to the point in my life where I say, God, you have any right to send me to hell. There's nothing that I can hold on to. I said to myself, my strength, my ability, my righteousness, my standing, all that I would be maybe proud about, it has perished. I let go of everything and I cast myself at nothing but your grace. And on the Reformation Sunday, that is what we think back to. That is what the reformers rediscovered in the Reformation. Solo, soli, sola, gratia. Nothing but the grace of God. I don't depend on the church traditions. I don't depend on what the church has to offer to me, but I absolutely resign myself to the sovereignty of God and say, God, if you in your sovereignty choose to show me loving kindness, then that is my only hope, although I'm not entitled to it. Now, we could turn the pages over that I gave to you and actually go through the whole end of the Old Testament and show how various other books, may it be Daniel, may it be the book of Esther, may it be the Psalms, how they further illustrate this exact fact, this point to which Jeremiah seeks to lead the people of Israel. Israel needed to learn not to depend on the temple, on the king, on the city of Jerusalem, but depend only on the spiritual promise that the Lord would be gracious to them, and that it is His loving kindness alone that they depend on. So, much more could be said. Much was said. I hope this was not too much. But it maybe gives you a little taste, yeah, how understanding the structure of a book, understanding how the author seeks to communicate to us, really for us opens up the way that we ought to understand the book and unearths or unlocks for us the riches of what the prophets of the Lord have intended for us to read and understand through the Old Testament.